Welcome to Knowledge Cast. This is a look into the world of knowledge management, information management, data management, and everything in between. This is brought to you by Enterprise Knowledge. I'm Zach Wall, founder and CEO of EK, and today we're speaking with Barbara Phillip, someone I've known in the field for a very long time. I think we have something like 200 shared connections on LinkedIn. Barbara is the Senior Advisor of Knowledge Management at Chemonix International and is also faculty, a professor at George Mason University Schar School of Policy and Government, where she teaches ODKM. Barbara, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, great. Thank you for inviting me.
As I shared with you before we started the recording, I can't believe it's taken so long. You are a big name in the field and have done just a ton of great work. So it's a real pleasure to have you on. And I'm sorry it took so long. Barbara, if you have listened, you would know that the way that I always like to lead off is by asking you to define KM. How do you explain what you do, what your passion is, to someone who's perhaps not so familiar with the letters K and M?
I think over the years, I've probably used many different versions of definitions of knowledge management. And I actually have a deck of cards that has like more than 80 versions of definitions. And I actually use that deck of cards in my class at George Mason to get the students to have a sense of the diversities of interpretations of what it is. And I'm not sure it's always a great idea because then they get the sense that, well, we don't even know what it is. So what's the point of studying it? But ultimately, I have a couple of favorite ones. The one that's the top of my deck of cards is from Thomas Davenport. And it's knowledge management is the process of capturing, developing, sharing, and effectively using organizational knowledge. So that's a pretty traditional one. Can I give you a second one?
Yes, please.
It's kind of similar, but I avoid the term organizational knowledge in this one. So here's the second one. Knowledge management is the strategic process of capturing, organizing, and analyzing knowledge within an organization to facilitate learning and improve decision-making. Mm. So there's a couple of additional components there, the learning and the decision-making, and really more of a strategic focus for the definition.
So I like Davenport's definition. The trick that I find with it is the focusing on organizational knowledge, and you kind of pulled that out, right? There's some limitation to that. Do you believe in that limitation, or do you think KM stretches beyond experiential or organizational knowledge?
I don't know that I would see it as a limitation. I think in the end, knowledge management needs to be so embedded in the processes of the organization, so tailored to the unique organizational processes and structures that any definition will work as long as you set it in the context of whatever that business is trying to do. I try not to get into the conversations around more of the semantics of knowledge management. And like,
thank you.
Sometimes these conversations turn into, so what is knowledge? And it's like, no, we don't want to go there.
I'm a big fan of the word stuff, because at the end of the day, we need to master all of an organization's stuff. Now, yeah. You've used the word a few times, and your second definition actually has it quite prominent, strategic processes of, or strategic yeah. process of. So would your argument or your thesis statement be that at its core, the field of knowledge management is process-based? It's about processes to, you know, for the verbs, capture, develop, share.
Yeah, and I would even say it's about embedded processes so that it's not, you know, separate knowledge management processes on top of existing business work. That's critical to make it sustainable and to make it fully targeted at the critical knowledge of the organization. That's why I focus on the word strategic. We need to make sure that it's directly connected to business objectives. It's not knowledge for the sake of knowledge and, you know, capturing for the sake of capturing. It needs to be really targeted and strategic.
I like that a lot. And that actually gets to the end of that second definition where you're saying the so that. And in consulting, these are really important words, right? Mm-hmm. We're not just building a search tool. We're not just doing KM. We're building a search tool or doing KM so that the organization can more effectively learn, or so that the organization can more effectively make decisions. So I really like that addition to the definition, the so that. Why those two? I don't disagree with them. Learning, decision-making, beautiful, wonderful, super important. But KM can do a lot more for an organization than those two. Why'd you pull those out discreetly?
I think those are the ones I've, in my career, been most focused on. I guess it depends. Some industries will focus on other things. Like I remember when I was working at NASA, the knowledge management was, to a large extent, more connected to risk management, for example. So if you are working at NASA, your definition might be really connected to reducing risk or something like that, as opposed to just decision making.
I really like that. I almost feel like if we were to go back to your definition, strategic processes of so that, and that, so that's almost like a fill in the blank, depending on the industry and the organization priorities. Now, the two that you did pull out initially, learning and decision-making, I do think are two of the most prominent, and two also that you can most effectively tie to hard and measurable return on investment. If you focus on learning, you're upskilling people faster, you're supporting them more effectively, that immediately translates to greater retention, you're saving money on training and learning, and you're saving money on replacing employees who have left. Tell me a story there. Tell me where you've seen that happen for an organization.
Maybe I'll go back to some of my experiences at NASA, because that's kind of where I really went deep in terms of learning the field, practically more than theoretically. In that case, it was really focused on the learning. Like, we do knowledge management to learn from our mistakes and successes, mostly mistakes, actually.
Yeah.
We do it to make sure that we understand what went wrong when something blows up or whatever, something happened. So a lot of connections to processes like root cause analysis and after action reviews and things like that. And the whole point is not to collect things and put them in a database of lessons, but to make sure that those lessons that we learn from an accident or an activity or whatever it is are analyzed correctly and then fully embedded in training of new employees and training of engineers and project managers and the like, so that there is a learning loop. So there's two things that I emphasize a lot with my students, but also at work. One is critical knowledge, which is related to the strategic processes. Like, we need to make this very strategic and targeted, focused on critical knowledge. And the second thing is knowledge flows. And that's related to the learning cycle. There's no point in doing knowledge management if you're not going to share what is being learned and embed it into learning processes and training. So that was a lot of what we did in my earlier work at NASA, was really making sure that we facilitated learning from project teams and then captured that in interesting ways and then shared it to different target audiences within the organization. So the flows of knowledge were facilitated as well, not just learning in the team, but learning across the different teams.
I want to repeat what you said there, and I'll paraphrase a little bit, but there's no point in doing KM if you're not actually going to do something with the knowledge that you've captured and managed. And I love that. And I think that's so important. How does an organization ensure that they're completing that loop? Because I agree. I think a lot of organizations will say, like, hey, we're capturing these we're doing retros and we're capturing lessons learned and we've got these great case studies, but then they don't actually extend it to something that's actionable or that gets pushed to the next person who could leverage that to ensure they don't repeat the same mistake. How do you complete that loop for an organization? What's your approach?
Yeah, I think that's where we really need to have a good grasp of the pull and push, the demand and the supply. If you capture things and you put them even in the best repository and with the best user interface or whatever, super user friendly, if you don't have demand for that knowledge, it's still not going to be used. So there are ways to push things to people who need it, right? There are ways to do that. There are ways to kind of force a little some processes to make sure that people actually use the resources. But ultimately, it's going to be based on a culture that has this kind of curiosity and intrinsic demand for knowledge that helps them do their job better. So I guess it's a matter of trying to create the demand when it doesn't exist, and change the culture a little bit, making sure that people see the need for those things. I'm not saying it's easy. It's actually quite hard in many, in many organizations to create that demand.
You've hit on culture twice now. And the first was when you talked about learning from mistakes. And NASA is very famous for this. And it's incredible that you have that experience under your belt. I think too many organizations, when they think about lessons learned, when they think about after actions, they're really comfortable celebrating their successes. It's easy to talk about what worked. How do you get an organization to be comfortable talking about what didn't work and celebrating failures?
So NASA did it well because, and this is interesting, because having worked in NASA and now back in international development, where it's a completely different culture for many different reasons. In NASA, when you're talking about failure, it's almost a matter of pride in identifying what went wrong and then making sure it doesn't happen again. And the failures in NASA are so visible that you can't really say, no, we didn't actually fail. I mean, it blew up. It's obvious, right?
Yeah.
So you can't hide it, and you have to address the issues. There's taxpayer money involved. That's kind of obviously you can't afford to waste these billions of dollars, right? In international development, you can't afford to waste the money either. But success and failure are much more, I don't know how to say it, it's softer concepts, right?
Yeah.
It's harder to say this was a complete success or this was a complete failure. It's mostly in the gray area of it worked or whatever. You don't have the same kind of black and white, it worked or it didn't work. And as a result, there is a lot of pressure to just document the way it worked or to say it succeeded, right? There's all kinds of evaluations of projects and we say it was successful in this and that way. And it's also difficult to talk publicly about the things that did not work. But well, even when we do talk about what worked, we're not really good at explaining why and how it worked. We're really good at saying, here are our wonderful results of this project. We were very successful and that's what we learned. Essentially, there's very little emphasis on learning how it worked and why it worked. We're just satisfied kind of with it worked and therefore we were successful. And, you know, it's kind of a very positive attitude towards things. And we learned that we achieved X, Y, and Z, which is not lessons learned.
No.
Even when you're successful, it's very difficult to get people to talk about what actually worked and what would you do again the same way? And are you sure that would work again? No, necessarily.
So in your role, how do you help to get to the actual lesson learned? Is it toddler method? You keep asking, but why until somebody gives you the real thing? Is it asking more specific questions? How do you get to the real thing that somebody can use to repeat the success instead of just knowing there was a success?
I don't actually do this in my current job, and I can explain what I'm focusing on in my current job in a minute. But when we did it at NASA, it was a matter of asking why and going deeper and getting the engineers and the scientists and project managers to actually, you know, dig deeper in their own thinking about what was it that they did well. And there's this tendency to say, well, we had great communications. Okay, that's not the lesson. Going deeper is like, what was great about those communications? Like, what kind of meetings did you have? What exchanges did you have? What made it so great? So you have to start digging further and further. Because otherwise, the first instinct is to just say some very generic. The two that I really got a lot was we had great communications, that we had great team. Or when it was a negative, it was, we should have started earlier. I love that.
I got it.
Yeah.
So you mentioned your role at Chemonix. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that, please, Barbara?
At Chemonix, I am in a very small team of knowledge management. So it's just me and one other person. It's two people. We are kind of very close to the CEO's office, so in a very nice position. But our focus is on corporate systems, meaning we manage the corporate library of project and technical documents, and we manage the enterprise social network.
Hmm.
We do a couple of other things, but we're not responsible for the knowledge management activities that happen at the project level.
Okay.
Which is why I don't facilitate pause and learn or after action reviews for the projects. And by the way, we have 120 projects around the world. You would need a very large team to start doing that. So the project themselves do a lot of traditional project level knowledge management, but I'm not involved in that much.
Got it. So you've been there, I think, a few years since 2019. And where's your energy placed on a daily basis? Or what's on the agenda? What do you want to accomplish? What have you accomplished? Tell us more about your role and what you've been able to do for the organization.
So 2019, when I joined, there were already quite a number of great things happening with knowledge management. We had a set of technical practices, so practice networks, very focused on different technical sectors that we work in. So I was at the time coordinating a little bit some of that. This has now been delegated to business lines, and I no longer manage that. One thing that we had already at the time was Yammer at the time, and now Viva Engage. So enterprise social network at the time, 2019, it was not very active. It had been launched, but very few people were using it. So one of the things I did was to relaunch it essentially with pretty good governance around it, so that each community needed to have a charter. I kind of used the World Bank playbook for community management and sort of adjusted it for what we needed at Chemonix. So we have now 25 really strong technical communities and a few other support communities that are managed by community managers. And we have 6,000 employees, and a good number are engaged on a regular basis. I wouldn't say it's perfect, but we have managed to create this global network of employees that are able to connect through that social enterprise network, which is much better than just relying on teams and other structures. So this coming year, I'm actually going to do a little bit more work on what I call the collaboration ecosystem to make sure that people across the company, our global workforce, have a great understanding of what tools to use for what purpose and how they can reach out to different groups within the organization using all of these different channels and not just Viva Engage and Teams, but make sure everybody understands where to go to find their colleagues and access the collective intelligence of the organization, essentially.
KnowledgeCast is brought to you by Enterprise Knowledge, the world's largest dedicated knowledge management consultancy. From training to benchmarks, strategy, design, prototyping, and all the way to enterprise-level implementations, Enterprise Knowledge wants to be your services partner, spanning the fields of knowledge management, knowledge graphs, data, learning, advanced content management, and enterprise artificial intelligence. Contact us at info@enterprise-knowledge.com to discuss how we can support you.
Let's go back to the social network governance, because I do think this is a piece that a lot of organizations miss. They think, hey, we're going to stand up a bunch of communities of practice and just let the magic happen. And it doesn't unless there's some really good management over it. Governance is not the most exciting word.
Yeah.
Can you talk to our listeners a little bit about the keys to what you put in there, what you thought was most critical, and how that's worked?
There might be a few pieces to this. I'll try to tackle them one at a time. One was just having some kind of governance to begin with, meaning you cannot just start a community randomly, call it whatever you want, and start connecting with two other people, and then you're done. That's not
right.
That was not the goal. We determined that we wanted different types of communities because we wanted some flexibility. So each of our technical practices established a community in what was Yammer at the time with a set of community managers identified. I drafted a template for a community charter. It's just one page, but it forced the community managers to identify what their intentions were, what were the objectives of the community, how they were going to manage it, even identifying some engagement targets. So the first year, maybe they wanted to have a target for members, a target for level of engagement, and a commitment on the part of the community managers to actually post and create the engagement necessary, reach out to the projects to let them know how to engage in the community and the like. Beyond that, we made it impossible after a while for people to create a community without coming to me from the KM team. And once they got to me, I helped them develop the community charter. And then I have a Viva Engage governance group, which is just three people. And we review the charters and we approve them. Or we go back and say, well, actually, what you're trying to do, you would be better off in Teams, and Viva Engage is not the right platform for you. That governance group is myself from the knowledge management team, one person from internal communications, and one person from the IT department.
You took the words right out of my mouth. I was going to ask, what's the team comprised of? The one that I expected to hear there that I didn't was legal. Is there within Chemonix, like in-house legal or any sort of regulatory group that also participates, or is that covered elsewhere?
We have a legal department, but they're not engaged in the governance around Viva Engage. Viva Engage for us is 100% internal.
Yeah.
So there are no risks of putting information that shouldn't go outside or anything like that. It's kind of a pretty controlled environment and people are very well behaved. So we haven't had any issues.
So what I find with these sorts of systems is they're most successful in mission-oriented organizations. Chemonix certainly checks that box. And they're also most successful in organizations where there's almost a clear understanding of expertise, where there are subject matter experts that are highly in demand, short of time, that others want to learn from. Is it that kind of standard eater-feeder model where each of your COPs or each of your communities is sort of owned by some SMEs that people want to learn from? Or is it a more balanced group of people within who are all sharing ideas and talking?
The technical communities are managed by what we call practice management teams. And those are not necessarily the experts in that field. There is a broader network of experts in those particular sectors that can engage in the community. I don't want to give the impression that it's all perfect and we've figured it out. But the fact is that a lot of the communities are used more for knowledge sharing and dissemination of information and not as much for actual conversations. And this is something I'm still struggling to change a little bit. I wish there were more conversations and real knowledge exchanges. It's still quite a bit of information push being pushed through these channels, which is good because it's getting pushed more globally. And once in a while, you'll get people asking a question or interacting, but it's still quite more of a publication mode than really conversation.
So if I'm understanding that right, somebody generates knowledge and then they effectively announce an idea or a piece of research or a finding within the community rather than people asking questions and others chiming in with answers.
Yes, part of the reason, or there might be a couple of reasons. One is psychological safety and language issues are still going to be a problem because all of our community, I didn't mention this, all of our communities are open, meaning that 6,000 people can see what you wrote. And that creates a little bit of anxiety for people who are worried about who's going to read this, people whose first language is not English, and they're a little concerned about writing the perfect post. And we have other avenues for people to have more of the deeper conversations. So people use Teams quite a lot to have more of the technical conversations that I wish would also happen in Viva Engage. So it's not that it's not happening across the organization, the deeper dialogue. It's just that it's happening in different places. And some of it is more constrained by a particular group, like it's in Teams and it has a particular membership. Whereas because our Viva Engage platform is completely open to 6,000 people, it does create a little bit of challenge in terms of the psychological safety and language aspects.
That's 100% one of those blockers to knowledge flowing or to people sharing their knowledge. One of the ways that I always like to see that broken for the better is for leadership to model the right behavior, for leadership to show some vulnerability, ask questions themselves within these communities, start chiming in with ideas or answers. What have you done to try to get people more comfortable or remove that psychological block to feeling like somebody's opinion is valid or warranted?
We've been lucky to have a CEO who has been a great champion for Viva Engage. Mm-hmm. I mean, he doesn't go to a meeting without mentioning it and encouraging people to chime in. So that's been great. That doesn't mean that every level of leadership has actually embraced the tool as their main communication tool. I think we do have psychological safety issues even with some of the leadership. And it's not the first place they go to. And early on, 2019, 2020, Yammer, when it was still Yammer, was not well integrated into the rest of the Microsoft suite of tools. It's much, much more integrated now. It's essentially in Teams. People can't tell me that it's not integrated. It's just in Teams and everywhere. But early on, it was like, oh, I have to go to yet this other tool to, you know, engage. It was kind of challenging to get people to pick a tool. It was like, that's what I would hear very often. Pick a tool. Just tell me which tool to use, but I don't want to go to 10 different tools.
Sometimes people just want to be told, right? You mentioned that's another part of your role, corporate systems, and helping people understand what to do where. And that can be very frustrating. How do you navigate that? And how do you help folks kind of map where to share which knowledge and where to go looking for what knowledge? How does that work?
So I started 2019 and we relaunched Viva Engage Yammer. And then, of course, COVID hit and we all went home to work remote. And we were lucky that we had the systems in place to continue working very efficiently. So that's when both Yammer and Teams blew up and started expanding rapidly in terms of usage. And that's when we decided, not just my team, it was a combination of knowledge management, HR, IT, and maybe some other folks. And we kind of got together and it's like, okay, we need to explain to people clearly in a diagram and just a few words, what tools to use for what purpose. And we also have an internal learning platform that we wanted to showcase. So we kind of explained, for you go to Yammer for these types of communications, you go to Teams for this, you use Outlook for that, and you go to this other platform for learning when you want to find resources around training and learning for yourself. It was a very nice graphic and additional little explanations of what to do where. We're actually about to revisit that graphic and reimagine it a little bit in the context of hybrid work right now. And also in the context of what I call, I think I mentioned it already, this collaboration ecosystem. Just because you've done something once doesn't mean it's done. You kind of have to revisit and repeat and rinse and start again. Yeah.
And this actually, I think it speaks to what you're describing as collaboration lifecycle, as well as the enterprise social networks and really everything you've talked about. One of the biggest challenges is not just having these things work, but knowing when and how to graduate knowledge. In other words, great conversation happening in community practice. How do you ensure it doesn't get buried under the fold or it gets buried under a different conversation? How do you move the best stuff that happens into a place that can exist prominently in the organization in perpetuity?
That's a challenging question. As the manager for the enterprise social network, I have all kinds of powers to like highlight things and, you know, share them more broadly within our other Chemonics tools and things like that. So some conversations get highlighted. You can also obviously tag leadership when you need to get them to engage in some of these conversations. But you're right. In many instances, this stays within the social enterprise network, right? Get stuck in there. And this is where having each of the key technical practice areas have their own community, it makes them responsible for extracting whatever critical information is being shared there. And they're responsible for making sure to tag the right people. So that's where community management becomes critical. Mm. It's not just, hey, let's just have a conversation. It's we are managing this community. We're managing the knowledge within that community. Yeah. We're going to pick up the conversation if it's really relevant and take it wherever else in the organization it needs to be visible, including creating new knowledge products out of whatever is being discussed within Viva Engage or outside. We had a big event a few weeks back, face-to-face event, and just now there's like a follow-up conversations happening in Viva Engage and things being posted, like summarizing the event. And I wasn't able to attend, so now I'm able to actually view the recordings of that big event. So it's like a flow of different access points for the different knowledge products and conversations that are happening.
That's a lot of responsibility. How do you arm people to be effective, to spot the stuff that should be elevated, to figure out to whom it should be disseminated, to figure out how to codify it into a new knowledge article? And you're talking about some pretty advanced stuff here. Is that part of your governance model? Is there training for that? Is that just ad hoc coaching? How do you make that work?
I don't actually do much of that because it's in the mandate of the practice management team. So all of the technical practices have a mandate. And they're so well embedded in the business lines that they know which proposal needs to have access to what. They know which project is facing a particular challenge. And they're the ones making the connections. You know, where I'm sitting, I have limited visibility into the 120 projects.
Yeah.
So I create the structure and maybe some of the governance, but essentially the technical experts in those practices are the ones who are in the middle of the work and need to be making those connections and help to facilitate all of that.
I mean, Barbara, that's pretty impressive. Is this the culture of Chemonics? Is this the foresight of your CEO? How did that come to be in such a strong and consistent way?
I think the practices have been at it for quite a long time, and they've evolved over time, just as the technology is involved and all of that. I actually have a document that's typewritten that talks about the practices. So Chemonix has been going at this for a long time.
Yeah.
The practices were essentially the early knowledge management aspect of what the organization was doing. We now have 13 practices covering essentially the gamut of technical sectors that Chemonix works in. And they do a lot of deep work that's fully embedded in proposal work, in project work, and even outreach. They do a lot of the outreach as well, work on our outreach efforts. So that's really kudos to them and to whoever set them up early on. And now what I've been focusing on is really more of, because as Chemonix has grown to 6,000 people, we now have issues at the organizational level that need to be addressed in terms of our data management, which I don't deal with the data aspects, but I closely connect with IT on some of the content management aspects at the organizational level and the structures. So it's a little bit more on the information management side than the traditional KM, like lessons learned kind of things that I used to do in my previous job.
Venn diagram, it sounds like your role is almost, there's some library science in there, there's some info science, there's some KM. I think that's such a critical takeaway for our listeners. There's very infrequently a pure KM role in an organization of any size. One must wear many hats. And Barbara, one thing I really respect about you is that you've mastered that over the course of your career. You have this wonderful multidisciplinary depth of knowledge that I think you're very humble about. I very much respect. What's on the plan for Chemonix? What else are you planning to do there that maybe is in its early stages? What did the next couple of years look like for you there?
Yeah, some very exciting stuff. I bet anybody you talk to right now would tell you there's some AI things coming that...
Haven't talked much about AI lately. Yeah.
So we have a new corporate strategy and we have a new team coming up. So I mean, things are moving. Like every year, things move a little bit organizationally. So things are going to be moving more this coming year, which I think is a great opportunity to adjust a little bit how we work around data, information, knowledge, and insights, and how we increasingly use technology to leverage our corporate knowledge. We have like 48 something years, I think, of experience. Of course, the late 70s are not particularly relevant to today, but still we have like this corpus of experience across many geographies and many partnerships and all that, that we want to be able to leverage using AI tools. But what I want to be careful about in our next years of efforts is not putting all of our eggs into the AI basket in a way.
Yeah.
Making sure that we still pay attention to the conversations, the knowledge flows, the people-to-people connections that we absolutely need to continue to strengthen and maintain. At the same time, there are so many new opportunities to have AI support KM and KM support AI that this is a very exciting time. It's a two-way street. I really like how AI can support a lot of KM tasks that are kind of manual and boring. And, you know, managing a library sometimes involves a lot of manual, boring stuff. I want the AI to do some of that for me. At the same time, I think a lot of KM is absolutely essential for AI to work well.
Yes.
And so I'm glad that some of our work is getting more attention now, precisely because you cannot unleash an AI tool on a pile of mess. It's going to be some garbage in, garbage out problem. And we need to clean up everything before we unleash the AI on it. That's my take on where we are.
100%. If that content isn't first accurate, reliable, but also structured and enhanced in such a way that the tools can actually ingest it, understand it, and make connections around it, there's no value in buying some fancy tool or building something. What do you see as the use cases that will be most valuable for Chemonix? Is it about combining past content? Is it about finding themes in it to make better decisions? Is it about pushing content to those who might need it, even if they don't know to ask? What's going to be the thing that changes the way you all do business?
I'll give you maybe two examples. One is at the corporate office, which is the Washington office. A lot of our work is obviously going to be around developing proposals and getting funding for our work. Mm-hmm. And a lot of developing proposal revolves around being able to pull from existing projects, understanding what works, what didn't work, and creating just the perfect technical approach, management approach, developing the best proposal possible. That requires an ability to look at our databases of documents and repositories of, and access the people, mm-hmm. right? So it's a combination of who are the people who have this knowledge across the organization and what has already been documented that we can pull from. Between the corporate library and all of our other repositories, that's a whole lot of documents that nobody has time to read. Or you can scan through, but if you're doing a traditional search, you end up with 20 documents and very few people will have the patience to go through that. So we need ideally an AI solution that will look at these documents, summarize, identify very narrow things that we're looking for that may be, you know, buried in two or three documents across all of our collections. So we need the help of AI for some of these efforts. Another one that I'm looking at a little more is we have large collections of photos from projects that are not organized. I mean, they're organized in folders with weird names and whatever. It's just a huge amount of photos. And we need to improve the process before we can apply AI to all of this. But we need to make sure we have the right consent forms and things like that when we try to take pictures of people. There's an entire process that needs to be updated. And then we can apply some AI to do image recognition and things like that. That's one of my ideas that I've pushed forward so far, but it's probably not going to be a priority. It's just an interesting one that I think we should try.
Well, it's a cool use case, and it goes back to my earlier point. Now you're talking about digital asset management and records management and KM and AI. It's a wonderful blend of all these different things. So the way you're talking, it sounds like, does AI fall within your mandate in your role in KM, or is this in partnership with others within the organization?
It's very much in partnership. It is not something that the KM team is leading. At this time, it is being led by sort of a group of different teams coming together, including our IT folks. And they're working really hard on creating the right data platform as the foundation for all of this. Yeah. So they're working very hard on the foundations. And then I work closely with our data and analytics team. In fact, as of January 1st, we'll be merged with the data and analytics team. That kind of tells you where we're going. Like, it's really strong alignment. And we're also closely working with an innovation team and even the media team. So it's like a new configuration of teams that is going to really take the lead in deciding what AI, how, for what purposes, very strategically organized. We're also being very careful about how we approach it. Like, I know a lot of people in the organization are in a hurry, like they want the AI yesterday. But the reality is, it's better if we take it not slow, but like carefully.
I also want to pull out the fact, I love the fact that KM and data are coming together within the organization. We're seeing that a lot. We actually orged ourselves that way at EK. We have a sector that runs knowledge and data services now. We did that a few years ago, I think prophetically. And it's striking to me how many organizations are going that route. And I think it bodes very well for the field of KM. Would you agree? What are your thoughts on that?
I would agree, as long as we don't forget about tacit knowledge and knowledge flows and the culture and all of that, because it's easy to get so focused on data and AI and the latest technology trends and things like that. And that's fine. And there's great potential there. But at the same time, we need to continue to focus on the people aspects, not just the people who are going to go find the data and, you know, access. It's not just users of their systems. It's people who have the knowledge in their head and need to share it in many different ways across the organization. So we can't forget about that aspect of knowledge management, even if the knowledge management team is merging with data.
I think that's very well said. I think it's a great point. I would double down on that and say that's one of the values that KM can bring to the data side of the house. Data historically has been all about the numbers, kind of by definition. But who's worked on those data? Who made which decisions? How many organizations are working in silos of data where they don't know that somebody else is actually doing something similar that they could learn from or that they could combine. I actually think that some traditional KM principles could be wonderfully transformative for traditional data work, if you follow me. So there's some great work to be done there for both sides of combining those two.
Yeah, absolutely. And then the other thing about AI and the current wave of data management is much more emphasis on unstructured data.
Yes.
So suddenly all of our collections of documents, which nobody has time to read, become more relevant because we can actually mine them much faster and better. So suddenly our collections of project-related documents become more valuable, especially if they've been curated correctly.
There you go. And this is stuff that we as professionals in the KM field have been talking about for 25 years and finally becoming possible. So exciting times. So Barbara, let's shift over to George Mason, your work there. You've been teaching since 2018. Tell us a little bit about what you teach and what gets you out of the bed in the morning, to what energizes you about teaching.
So I did a PhD, but not because I wanted to teach. And I ended up teaching because I like the idea of sharing knowledge, which makes sense from a knowledge management professional practitioner. George Mason is like in my backyard, essentially. You guys too are in my backyard. I teach just one class every semester. I mean, every fall semester. Mm-hmm. It's called Knowledge Management and Collaborative Work. It's part of a two-year ODKM program, Organizational Development and Knowledge Management graduate degree. They come to my class in the second year, so they've already had a little bit of knowledge management and quite a bit of OD classes. And in my class, we go through reviewing what is knowledge management. Then we do knowledge capture and codification. We do knowledge sharing and collaboration tools. Then we do something around knowledge management strategies, how to develop a knowledge management strategy. And the final big session is around implementation challenges. So communications for KM, change management for KM, metrics, how to measure success and things like that. The big element in the class is not so much my lecturing or talking about what I do, but it's a consulting project that the students go and do with a real world organization. They go in teams of three or four, and they go do a little bit of a consulting assignment, which I try to organize for them ahead of time. But they're still responsible for developing the scope of work, because that's kind of almost the hardest part.
Yes, I know that to be true, for sure. That's wonderful. I guess this gels, but one of the questions I always like to ask our accomplished professionals on KnowledgeCast is, what would you recommend to somebody who wants to grow up to be you?
I think I would go back to first looking at personal knowledge management and understanding your own knowledge habits, like understanding how, as an individual, you process knowledge, you learn from practice, you learn from other people. Understanding that at an individual level is probably the starting point, because then it allows you to understand better how people do it, how other people, how employees in your organizations do it, and what are their pain points. And why are they doing what they're doing? Why are they not sharing? Like, understanding it at an individual personal level is probably a very good starting point. Then there are all kinds of books and certifications and all kinds of things people can do. There are not that many professional degrees directly related to KM. There are, you know, maybe two or three in the US. But I think that doesn't necessarily matter. There's all kinds of ways to learn and become a knowledge management practitioner, even if your title never says knowledge management.
And many don't. That's a really great point. What are you most excited about as the field has pretty rapidly changed? What do you feel like is going to be beyond just the generic AI thing? Like, what's cool about the field right now, Barbara?
I don't know if it's about the field, but I have this slightly unique, maybe it's not unique, but I don't find that many people who are fascinated by maps. And I'm talking about concept maps, knowledge graphs, the connections between all of these different things. I was doing knowledge maps and insight maps and things like that beginning at my work at NASA. So maybe like 15 years ago.
Yeah.
And then suddenly knowledge graphs became a thing. And I'm like, this is so totally related to how my brain works. And I was like fascinated by how knowledge graphs are becoming key tool for knowledge management in the age of AI. And even though I still don't grasp the technical details of it, I still think it's like super interesting because of the way it helps think about how things are connected.
I mean, I completely, it's one of the things that we're most excited about at EK and seeing organizations invest deeply. And it is a bridge to AI. It is the thing that can bring together an organization's knowledge assets, their people, their content, their data, all of their stuff together in a way that's really actionable. So I love that answer. It's something that thrills me about the field right now, for sure. Barbara, what must an organization do to be successful, to be a healthy or mature knowledge management or knowledge sharing organization? What's your one must that we'll leave with?
I'm not very comfortable with these kinds of questions that are like, what is the one thing?
Only a Sith speaks in absolutes. I know, but it'd be a really long podcast if I said, give me your top seven. Give me one.
I think I would start with one of the things that are essential is a deep collective understanding of the benefits of knowledge management.
Which can be very unique to an organization, right?
Yes, which would be unique to that organization. Because if you don't have that, if you have some very superficial understanding, or if you have different understandings of what it is across the organization, then you get in trouble because you can't really get alignment on what you're doing. And you have to constantly explain. You always have to constantly explain anyway. But you have to build that alignment and that deep understanding of why you're doing what you're doing across the organization, and not just the top leadership. Like, it has to be below that as well.
I think you just described not just the key of KM, but the key of operational effectiveness, which probably speaks to, again, your multifaceted expertise. But I love that as a takeaway. Barbara Phillip, Senior Advisor for Knowledge Management at Chemonix, as well as Professor at George Mason University. Thank you so much for your leadership in the field and your expertise. And personally, it's always a pleasure to speak. I learn something every time we talk. So thanks and have a great day.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
All right. And to our listeners, thanks for joining this episode of KnowledgeCast. And to check out more, as always, visit our website at enterprise-knowledge.com, where you will find one of the world's largest knowledge bases, free and open, no paywall, no logins, just lots and lots of knowledge assets. Have a great day, y'all.